Hello, this is Tamara, reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, March 18th. Let's start with the front page. We have a photo of election judge Shelley Edwards handing a ballot to Norma Parker for the primary election at the GT Church polling place in Decatur on Tuesday, March 17th. Voters trickle in during primary election. From Donette Beckett. Julie Salmons, 55, knew it was important to vote in Tuesday's primary election. "We need changes around here, not just with the law, but with everything," she said, after she cast her vote at the GT Church polling location. "Hopefully with us voting, maybe it does make some change." Jean Spears, 71, said she has always voted in the primary election. "You're supposed to," she said at the polling place in Richland Community College. Her neighbor Don Mayo gave another reason. "If you don't vote, you can't complain," he said. Macon County Clerk Josh Tanner oversees each voting process. "Mid-morning turnout was slow," he said. "Probably because of the weather. It's cold today," he added. For more about Tuesday's primary election, you can go to the herald-review.com. However, the day had been going smoothly, according to Tanner. "All of our polling places are open. All of our judges showed up. Equipment's all working," he listed. "They're ready to go when the voters show up." Many voters took advantage of the early voting option. "It's built up as it usually does," Tanner said. "It started out slow, then kind of builds as we get closer and closer to the weekends." Tanner said he expected approximately 23% of Macon County voters will vote in this year's primary election. Last year, about 16,000 people voted in the early election. "We're expecting the same in this election," he said. By mid-morning, Yvonne Taylor, election judge at Richland Community College, had been witnessing the same results. "The cold weather didn't help," she said, "but it looks pretty out there. It's not raining," she said. "People just aren't concerned like they should be." The general election in November has a better turnout, according to the judges. With nearly 4,000 registered voters in the three precincts voting at Richland, the judges were hoping for more than 400 to vote on Tuesday. "Voter fraud may be a concern among voters, but not with the election judges. The judges are on top of it," Tanner said, "and you will get caught." Election Judge Jason Martin assisted voters at the GT Church polling location with four precincts. "It's been a steady trickle," he said, "but we're used to the presidential election. The judges are trained to watch for fraud. It's not a concern," Martin said. Tom Morris is a rookie election judge with three elections under his belt. "There's so many checks and balances here, I found it's very tough for someone to get voter fraud," he said. March 17, 2026 isn't just Election Day. It was also St. Patrick's Day. Dressed in their finest shamrock-inspired clothing, election judges at the Macon County Building Annex on Wood Street were in the spirit of the holiday. "We like to bring fun to the Election Day," said Carolyn Wagner, "because it is a process." Voting hours were 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday. "And I come in and open up before that," said Michaeline Ellis, election coordinator. "Then I'm the last one out the door, I'm hoping around 10 o'clock. Election Day is important to the judges. As a little girl, Wagner would tag along with her father when he voted. There, she found her grandmother working as an election judge. "It was really cool to see my grandma in an official role," she said. "It made me want to do that when I retired." Wagner retired as a nurse practitioner 8 years ago. "I love getting to see the people and making sure people understand the process," she said. "It was instilled in me as a kid. You vote." From Tony Reed in Decatur, property survey offers good blighted news. There's good news and there's blighted news about the condition of homes and properties across much of Decatur. The update arrived on the doorstep at Monday evening City Council meeting when professional staff presented the results of the 2025 Community Revitalization Survey. The survey, the last of several conducted since 2019, looks at the overall condition of some 14,628 parcels of property scattered across 19 neighborhoods in the city's urban core, including the West End, and represents 41% of all land parcels citywide. Blight indicators examined ranged from overgrown lots and general decay to specifics like roof damage, siding damage, broken windows and doors, and dilapidated porches. Lacey Elsey, the city's economic and community development director, gave the good news first. Most structural condition indicators remain relatively low, with approximately 80% of indicators at or below 11%, suggesting that widespread structural distress is not present across most neighborhoods, she said in a written report to council. Equalized assessed value increased in 18 of the 19 surveyed neighborhoods between 22 and 25, with most neighborhoods experiencing 10 to 26% growth, indicating overall growth in the city's tax base. And then the bad news. Areas of concern identified in the survey include Torrance Park, Near East Side, and Wabash Crossing, which show higher structural deterioration or declining property values compared to other neighborhoods, Elsey reported. Survey mapping also shows geographic clustering of neighborhoods experiencing distress, particularly in areas surrounding the Martin Luther King Jr., Near East Side, Wabash Crossing, and Torrance Hill Park neighborhoods, which may support a coordinated regional revitalization strategy. Councilman David Horn liked the good news about the neighborhoods with reduced blight and rising property values. "First of all, kudos to you and your team," he told Elsey. "You've been working very hard, and it's always exciting to see when these scores improve, right? And that is what we're consistently seeing from 2019 through today, so kudos to that." But on the flip side, Horn said he was concerned by some 17 out of 18 surveyed neighborhoods having a blight score of more than 10%, while areas in 8 of 18 neighborhoods had blight scores rising past 30%. Horn said it was time to focus on some targeted plans to work on pulling those blight scores downwards. In comments to the Herald and Review before the meeting, Horn said he was particularly distressed by the deterioration of rental homes in the once pristine Wabash Crossing development, home to more than 670 residences, and where construction was only completed in 2007. And development was a public-private partnership with the Decatur Housing Authority. Other council members have also spoken out previously about their concern at the decline and dilapidation of Wabash Crossing homes, noting vacant residences falling into disrepair and not even being properly secured. Elsey said at Monday's meeting that the revitalization survey results will act as a map for city staff to guide revitalization strategies, prioritize resources, and inform future policy discussions. And she said staff also will be evaluating whether a more targeted neighborhood strategy or a broader-based attack on blight is the best way to try and fix things. Councilman Pat McDaniel mentioned city grant programs to rehabilitate homes and save neighborhoods by giving families a chance at home ownership. But he worried that some of those families aren't able to afford it long term. If we are putting them in homes that they can't financially maintain, then they end up losing it, and then their credit goes down, he said. Overall, however, he said he liked what the city was doing with the property survey and efforts to target resources in the best way to make a positive difference, even if that work is likely to take a while. "Having been born and raised in Decatur and lived in, what, 9 different neighborhoods, I know some of them were going down even in the 60s, and so it's just going to take time to bring some of these areas back up," McDaniel said. In local business, McDonald's employee honored, from Donette Beckett. Lane Woolery is going to be a member of the McDonald's Golden Team. With family and McDonald's management and staff gathered in the Mount Zion Road restaurant's dining area, Woolery was surprised to read her name on this year's invitation to McDonald's worldwide convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. "That's me," she said after reading her name in the announcement. Woolery, 21, was nominated by the crew and local McDonald's co-owner Andy Birschbach for the honor to attend the international convention. This year, the event will be June 1st through 4th in Las Vegas, Nevada. "She's a very good worker," Birschbach said. "She is the ideal crew person you want to send to this type of event." After graduating from Richland Community College, Woolery will be attending University of Northern Iowa in the fall. "She's currently a crew trainer, so she's moved up in the ranks," Birschbach said. Woolery's parents weren't surprised their daughter was nominated for the selective award. Brenna and Rocky Woolery and her 18-year-old brother Landon were all there to see the excitement. "She's such a responsible person, and she just takes her job very seriously," her mom said. "We're just so proud of her." The last Golden Team member sent by the local McDonald's franchise was in 2004. You don't get many applicants who get to go, Birschbach said. Out of 1,200 McDonald's restaurants associated with the Chicago field office, which includes restaurants in Iowa, northern Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois, only 10 crew members were chosen to attend the event. Woolery will be one of more than 200 representing the United States with another 400 international crew members. The teams will be interviewed and get to meet the upper-tiered McDonald's management, including McDonald's president, Chris Kepczynski. Woolery will get to see what goes on behind the scenes while she is working with other McDonald's employees. During the convention, test kitchens will be operating. Any new products and products from around the world, they'll test them in these kitchens. And they feed everyone that's coming for the convention, Birschbach said. She'll be privy to all the new items that could be coming down the road. During past conventions, McDonald's newest sandwich, the Big Arch, was tested. The newest sandwiches, flurries, fries, and McCafe drinks are often on the menu at the convention. It's not all work for the honored crew members. The all-expenses-paid event will include transportation, housing, time to visit Las Vegas, and a ticket to the final night event, which often includes a popular musician. And she gets paid for working, Birschbach said, so she'll be earning money. Past conventions were held in Barcelona, Spain, and Orlando, Florida. While Birschbach is also at the convention, he will be studying the newest additions and enhancements to stores. The owners recently announced they will be building a new McDonald's restaurant in the South Shores area. On our front page, we also have a second photo from the election day. Election Judge Betty Garcia is shown handing a sticker to Don Mayo at the Richland Community College polling place in Decatur on Tuesday. Now from local and state news, Tony Reed in Decatur. Decatur Transit Pay launches enabling riders to go contactless. Passengers can now hop on board the Decatur fixed route buses with a ticket to ride without having to get their hands dirty touching actual money. On Monday, the Decatur Public Transit System launched a new contactless fare collection system called Decatur Transit Pay, or DTP. It enables riders to plan, purchase, and validate trips through a smartphone app or reloadable smart card. Lacey Elsey, Economic and Community Development Director for the City of Decatur, predicts the DTP system will reduce boarding times and simplify fare management. This launch represents a major step forward in modernizing public transportation in Decatur, said Elsey. By introducing flexible cashless payment options and digital tools, we're making it easier for residents to access reliable transportation while positioning our transit system for long-term growth. She said the new way of collecting fares will also make it easier for administrators to track how the bus system is being used and so improve planning and the understanding of riders' needs. Cash will still be accepted on the fixed route system, while the Decatur Moves Microtransit is already a digital-only payment service. Riders can book trips, purchase fares, and manage their own travel histories through a new web portal. Go to DecaturTransitPay.com for more information and to download the Decatur Transit Pay app for Apple and Android devices. And for riders who don't want to use their phones to pay for fares, reloadable smart cards connected to e-wallets are available to provide a tap-and-go alternative. Riders can also book trips by calling 217-424-2821. Again, that is 217-424-2821. Big Blue on course for big bucks. Tony Reed in Decatur. Big Blue is all set to get its big buck loan after the Decatur City Council signed off on a city bond issue ranging up to $53 million on behalf of Millikan University. The unanimous decision, absent Councilman David Horn, a Millikan biology professor who recused himself, was voted through at Monday evening's council meeting. And it obliges taxpayers to essentially do the private school a big financial favor. The city's federal tax-free status as the entity floating the bonds means Millikan gets the money at lower interest rates. And investors don't pay federal income tax on the interest earned, making the purchase of the bonds a more attractive option for them. City Manager Melissa Hahn, was careful to set the scene for the vote by emphasizing that the city and its taxpayers are just the conduit for giving the school a break by agreeing to issue the bonds. Milliken is solely on the hook to pay them back and meet the costs. Milliken's new president, Dean Pribinow, holds a doctorate in educational leadership and was at Monday's meeting to give council members a primer on his school's symbiotic relationship with its host city. I've been talking at every chance I get about the critical importance of this relationship between the university and the city, he said. I've often said, as goes Milliken, so goes Decatur, and as goes Decatur, so goes Milliken. We are intrinsically linked. The 125-year-old private school says it needs the bond favor from the city to get cash to pay off existing debts and also to provide funds for campus improvements and modernization. Council members were also handed study guides spelling out Milliken's economic impact to the city. One estimate values the school as being worth more than $70 million to the Decatur economy while supporting some 765 jobs on and off campus. Seldom was heard a discouraging word in response to all this, but there were some. City Councilman Dennis Cooper wanted to table the bond vote to give the council more time to study the issue and hear from constituents. And he had some pointed questions for Jeff White, the financial expert advising Milliken on the bond issue and who made a pro-bond pitch at Monday's meeting. Cooper asked White that if the school defaulted, could investors still slap the city with a lawsuit? White said they could. He also confirmed that the city might have to rack up legal costs defending its case if it gets sued. Cooper was worried. So I don't want the public to think that we may not have to use city funds at some point in time if that, being sued, was to happen. And there probably would be some very costly city funds. White, however, said the legal protections for the city were very strong and unhappy investors were unlikely to beat a path to Decatur's door. They're not going to waste a lot of time making the city's life miserable because they'd be trying to squeeze blood from a turnip, he added. The vote to table the bond vote lost 4-2, with Councilwoman Consuelo Cruz voting with Cooper, and then came the unanimous vote to approve. Milliken University was founded in 1901 by Decatur banker James Milliken and a group of his wealthy friends. The school typically educates a 1,800-strong undergraduate class and 90 graduate students. The 2026 edition of Best Colleges ranked Milliken at number 15 in the Regional Colleges Midwest category. The school claims a 99% graduate success rate, finding a job or getting into graduate school, and a 47% four-year graduation rate. The student-to-faculty ratio is 10-1. And continuing with higher education, from Peter Hancock, Capital News, Illinois, in Springfield. We have a photo of Governor J.B. Pritzker signing legislation at the University of Illinois, Springfield in 2021. Governor J.B. Pritzker is calling on agencies in his administration to set goals for increasing the number of adults in the state with college degrees or other post-secondary credentials. In an executive order issued Friday, Pritzker announced the formation of a working group that will review the state's existing workforce development programs, consult with industry and labor groups, as well as local economic development organizations, and recommend new higher education attainment goals. That order comes on the heels of multiple reports showing the state has fallen short of previous goals for improving educational attainment, and that many barriers still prevent people from lower income backgrounds from completing college and climbing up the economic ladder. In 2009, the General Assembly established the Illinois P20 Council to make recommendations for developing a seamless and coordinated system of public education, covering preschool through graduate and professional. Among that group's recommendations was that by 2025, at least 60% of the state's adult population should have either a college degree or some other kind of high-quality post-secondary credential. But a report released this past October found the state appeared to be falling just short of that goal. In its biennial report, The State We're In, the nonpartisan research and advocacy group Advance Illinois reported that as of 2023, only about 57.4% of adults had finished a degree or credential program. That was still a significant improvement from 41% in 2008. In his executive order, however, Pritzker cited workforce projections that indicate by 2031 more than 70% of all jobs will require education or training beyond high school. Meanwhile, a pair of reports last year from the Illinois Workforce and Education Research Collaborative, or IWERC, found significant disparities exist in access to the benefits that are supposed to come with earning a college degree. In a July report, the organization found college degrees do, in fact, lead to higher earnings overall, but even after earning a degree, students from lower-income family backgrounds tend to earn less than those from wealthier backgrounds, even when they earn similar degrees and go into similar careers. And in a follow-up report in December, IWERC found that while some career pathways that don't require college degrees can lead to good-paying jobs and upward mobility, including construction, manufacturing, and wholesale trade, many of those pathways were promising only for men or for specific racial and ethnic groups. In his order, Pritzker highlighted statistics showing that since he came into office, the state has taken steps to make college more affordable, such as increasing funding for monetary award program and AIM High grants. He also noted that the percentage of in-state undergraduate students at public universities paying no tuition or fees has risen to 44% in fiscal year 25, up from 24% in 18. The new working group will consist of representatives from several state agencies, including the Board of Higher Education, Community College Board, State Board of Education, Student Assistance Commission, Department of Employment Security, Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, and the Illinois Workforce Innovation Board. It will also include advisory members from the Departments of Human Services, Corrections and Public Health, as well as the Office of First Lady M.K. Pritzker. The board is supposed to issue its recommendations to the governor by December 1, 2026. And now part one from our opinion page, our first column on miracle medication from Allison Sexton Ward. Drugs can lower obesity rates, healthcare costs. Alarmed by rising rates of obesity, public health officials have urged Americans for decades to eat better, move more, and make healthier choices. Yet obesity rates kept rising, peaking at 40% of Americans in 22. The decline since then is linked to something else, a new class of medications known as GLP-1. The arrival of these drugs has historic implications for Americans' health. Obesity and its related conditions, including diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancer, are responsible for a large percentage of deaths annually and account for a significant part of the nation's $5.3 trillion in health care costs. GLP-1 medications like semaglutide and tirzepatide help patients lose 15 to 20% of their body weight, outcomes that behavioral interventions have never achieved at scale. Yet insurance coverage for GLP as prescribed for weight loss remains limited. Millions of Americans lack access to treatments that could lengthen and improve their lives while bending the curve of U.S. healthcare spending. Research at the University of Southern California's Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics finds that widespread access to GLP-1 therapies could generate significant benefits to society. Young adults starting treatment between ages 25 and 34 could gain nearly 2 years of life expectancy, spend nearly 6 fewer years with diabetes, and reduce their risk of hypertension, heart disease, stroke, and cancer. Even Medicare beneficiaries who start treatment between ages 65 and 74 can expect to live about 6 months longer and experience reduced time living with diabetes. Research also shows that Medicare coverage alone would generate nearly $1 trillion in cumulative social benefits over the next decade. Medicare itself would save between $175 billion and $245 billion in the first 10 years, with 60% of savings from reduced hospitalizations and nursing home care. Investment in broad access could generate real returns exceeding 13% yearly, even after accounting for treatment costs, performing better than the U.S. stock market over this century. While the value of GLP-1 treatment varies by age and underlying health risk, all groups would see positive lifetime gains. Broad access could also dramatically reduce health disparities. Obesity disproportionately affects Black and Hispanic Americans, with 43% and 37% of each population affected, respectively. Black adults experience significantly less weight loss from behavioral interventions compared with white adults, and lower-income individuals have less access to these programs. The status quo, relying on lifestyle modifications, has expanded existing health disparities. Like beta blockers for hypertension, GLP-1 simplify treatment. After beta blockers' approval in 1967, reductions in hypertension and cardiac disease were more equal across income levels. The medication bridged the gap that behavioral interventions couldn't. Critics argue that GLP-1s cost too much to broaden access. That case is fading quickly. Injectable prices as high as $1,300 per month have fallen 50% or more. A new once-a-day GLP-1 pill, which could significantly increase the number of patients who would consider treatment, has a starter price of $149 a month. Unfortunately, fewer than one-third of insurers cover GLP-1 medications for weight loss, and Americans who pay cash for the drugs can't count these costs towards their insurance deductibles. Medicare has covered the drugs only for the treatment of diabetes, or in some case, for obesity-related heart disease. The history of diabetes offers an important parallel. Just as diabetes came to be recognized as a biological disease rather than a lifestyle, one treatable with insulin, it is time to extend the same understanding to obesity treatment. Ward is a research scientist at the USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. She wrote this for InsideSources.com. On our food page today, we have Sweet Nostalgia, a supersized, shareable version of a beloved classic snack cake. From Sarah Holden, TheKitchen.com. Ding Dongs are a classic snack of little glazed chocolate cakes filled with fluffy white frosting. While the original Hostess snack cakes were created in the 1960s, Ding Dong-inspired cakes have become increasingly popular in recent years. My homemade Ding Dong cake is a slightly elevated play on the childhood favorite. In this recipe, rich chocolate cake is layered with a not-too-sweet, creamy filling and generously slathered with fudgy chocolate ganache. The result is a balanced chocolate-forward cake that will have both kids and adults going back for seconds. Sarah Holden is a contributor to TheKitchen.com, a nationally known blog for people who love food and home cooking. Submit any comments or questions to editorial@TheKitchen.com. For a complete list of ingredients and instructions to make the cake and the ganache, please see the in-print version of the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, March 18th, page B5. Tonight on Turner Broadcasting, TCM, at 7 p.m., you can catch a classic, National Velvet. Elizabeth Taylor's lifelong commitment to charitable causes is almost as famous as her acting career. Tonight's tribute to Hollywood humanitarians begins with one of her most beloved early roles, National Velvet, 1944. Taylor was just 12 years old at the time and played a determined young girl who dreams of entering her horse in England's Grand National Race. Taylor's performance helped establish her as a true star. Mickey Rooney and Ann Revere offer wonderful supporting turns in a story that still inspires generations of animal lovers and dreamers. Today in history, in 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court in Gideon v. Wainwright ruled unanimously that state courts were required to provide legal counsel to criminal defendants who could not afford to hire an attorney on their own. In 1965, the first spacewalk took place as Soviet cosmonaut Alexei Leonov went outside his Voskhod 2 capsule secured by a tether. In 1990, two thieves posing as police officers subdued security guards at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum of Art in Boston and stole 13 works of art valued at over $500 million. The works have not been recovered. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour. Please stay tuned.